Okay. So, as I mentioned, the context for this, originally I was going to start really at the Mishnah, but we'll come back to the Mishnah. The Mishnah, the sugyot that come right after the Mishnah are a bit more technical about Ktivat Sefer Torah. But that's the context, right? We are talking about the writing of Sefer Torah. That's where we are. Okay? We're good? That's where we are. In the middle of that context, right, so the Gemara introduces a discussion, right, once we're talking about these halachot of the Sefer Torah, it introduces a halacha, right? What is the halacha that it introduces? You read the Gemara, and you can read it, you can tell me in the Hebrew, because yes, there are like five different positions of what this means. Yeah, that the last eight psukim in the Torah, Yachid Kore Otam. Okay? Then the Gemara goes on and says, well, why Yachid Kore Otam? Whatever that means, right? Whatever that means. So the Gemara suggests what? Let's just get the contours of the Gemara. Did everybody get to the bottom of the Gemara? End of the Gemara? Okay, good. No? No. Okay, so let's get the contours of the Gemara. Right? The Gemara introduces a halacha. Yachid Kore Otam. The last eight psukim are different halachically in some way. And what does the Gemara at least propose the reason for that is? So, let's sharpen it a bit, right? What is the Gemara's actual claim, right? What does it think that halacha depends on? Right, you're right, that's the machloket, what? Right, and that halacha would only be true according to which position? In the original, right, the original proposal. Right, meaning that it's written by someone. Right, so very simple, right? The first attempt of the Gemara, right, is that, right, the last eight psukim, right, the last eight psukim, right, are halachically different. Let's just say that, right? Right, whatever Yachid Kore Otam means, right, because, right, why?
Because they were written by
right.
Either Yahuwah.
Do you guys know formal logic at all? Okay, I'll teach you formal logic, right? And this is like the most basic thing in the world, right? This is just if P, then Q, right? Meaning if this, then that, meaning this follows from this, right? So Gemara's first attempt is, right? If Yoshua wrote the last eight psukim, then they are halachically different, right? Now, if you guys know formal logic, what follows from if P, then Q? The contrapositive, which is?
If not Q, then
thank
not
you.
P.
If not Q, then not P, right? Meaning, if it is forbidden for the, right, for someone to read, for the, if this halacha is not true, that must be because Yeshua did not write them, right? You with me, or is this just overcomplicating it, right? Right, meaning the Gemara at the beginning said the only way to justify this position, namely that the last eight psukim are different, is if you think Yoshua wrote them. But if Moshe wrote them, then a Yachid could not, right? The contrapositive, right? If not this, then not this, right? But the Gemara's conclusion is correct, right? That these are not, these don't hang on each other. Meaning, this is just a halacha, right? The last eight psukim can be read by a yachid, whatever that means, and it has nothing to do with the authorship question. Because, in the end of the day, there are two possibilities, which is either Yoshua wrote them or Moshe wrote them bidema, whatever that means, right? Right. Either way, these psukim are different than the rest of the Torah, and therefore the halachot are different regardless of authorship. Okay? Anyone who got to the bottom of the Gemara, is that a fair summary of the general contours of this argument? Yeah? We good? Yeah? Okay, fine. So, that's, again, that's just the general, right, the general outline of the argument, right, is that first the Gemara introduces a halacha, Yachid Kore Otam, right, the last Ipsukim, whatever that means, they're halachically different than the rest of the Torah. The Gemara suggests that that's only true if they were written by a different author, and the Gemara concludes, no, it doesn't matter, right, whether you think that Yoshua wrote them, or you think Moshe wrote them, Bidema, whatever that means, they are different, and therefore it is legitimate for them to be different halachically, right, because the way they were written was different, either in authorship or in context, method, however you understand bidema. And again, we're going to deal with that, okay? So, if I asked you now, what things do we need to understand in this Gemara, right? To fully understand everything that happened in the Gemara, and I know not everyone got to the bottom, but just, what things are we going to have to analyze to fully understand the sugya from beginning to end? I'm just grabbing these. This is the eraser part fell off of this. Want to get me a paper towel or whatever? The paper towel's fine. Right? What things do we have to analyze? Right? Tell me what things we got to analyze. Right? What questions do we need to assess to fully understand everything that just happened in the sugya? Yeah. Okay. We're gonna have to figure out what exactly does it mean. Yached koreyotam. Right? What does that mean? Right? What else do we have to figure out?
What does it mean, bidema?
Good, right? What does bidema mean? Right? What does this mean? And why does this matter? Right? Right? Meaning, okay, Yeshua wrote it, that's different. Whatever this means, why would that lead to this halacha? Right? Meaning, we need to understand it independently. Yeah, what else?
And also, if there might be an assumption that second thing, that
right, we need to understand both stages of the Gemara, right? Meaning, the first stage of the Gemara thinks that Moshe Katav Bidema is irrelevant to this, right? The second, the Gemara's conclusion is that, right, this has the same halachic import of Yeshua Katav Otam, right? What else do we need to understand?
They have the same import, doesn't that mean they would both change, they would both make it different?
Correct, that's the Gemara's conclusion. Hol v'ishni ishni.
So then what is
that? That's the Gemara's rejection of this Tliyah. Right? Meaning, it rejects this. Right? P stays true, Q stays true, but they have nothing to do with each other. Right?
Is that they are
at least Daniel was with me when I explained this on Shabbos. Right? There's, right? This is something that will help you in life. Okay? The difference between the validity of an argument and the truth of an argument. Okay? What is the difference? Right? The different validity means that A follows from B. Right? Truth is about whether A or B are true, right? Meaning, if I say, my name is Jonathan, therefore this is Migdal HaTorah, both of those statements are true, but that argument is invalid. Because the fact is Migdal HaTorah has nothing to do with the fact that I'm Jonathan. One doesn't follow from the other, even though both statements are true, right? That is a invalid but true, right? Those are true statements, but an invalid argument, right? A false but valid argument would be, right? If a unicorn is in a zoo, then unicorns exist. Right? That is an undeniably valid argument. Right? Meaning if I see a unicorn, it must exist. That does not mean that unicorns exist. It just means that if they existed, right, then they exist. Right? If I see them, then they exist. That's a valid argument, but the assumption is actually false. Right? There is no, right? So the Gemara is not weighing in here on the truth of these statements. Right? The Gemara is saying it could be Yeshua wrote them, it could be Moshe wrote them. It's just that P doesn't follow from Q, right? That Q doesn't follow from P, right? Meaning whether or not Yachid Koreotam is independent of P. It's just a standalone, right?
Meaning that,
right? It is a true statement, but the argument is invalid. Yes?
Q being okay? That
Q is Yachid Koreotam, or let's call this, right? Let's call it Yud. Okay? Yud. Well, this is not going to work because I was about to say Yehoshua. So that's not going to work. Okay? Right? We'll just call it Yachid, right? Fine, that's the whole word. Right? The Gemara thought this. Right? If Yehoshua wrote them, then Yachid Kareota. Right? The Gemara says this could be true, but it has nothing to do with this. This is a standalone true thing. Yachid Kareota. It has nothing to do with whether Yehoshua wrote them at all. Right? It has to do with something else, which is called different, right? That's it. It's just, if different, right? If this is different, Ha'ol v'ishtini, then the halacha is different. That's all. But it's not about Yeshua writing that. Okay? Fine. What else do we got to figure out? Right? This is in the Gemara, but there's something else that's very important here, which is? Yeah, right? We got to figure out why did the Gemara make this claim to begin with? Right? The Gemara claims either Yeshua wrote them or Moshe wrote them, Bidema, but what drove that, right? And is its argument valid, right? What is the argument, right? They have a machloket, right, about, in the Gemara, about why would you say Moshe wrote them? Why would you say Yeshua wrote them, right? We got to figure out both what drove them to this place and what drives them to reject, right? right? This is a machlokes, right? Why would you accept or reject the claim that Yeshua wrote them, right? These are all questions we have to deal with, okay? Now, one last point I want to make before we actually get into it, but guys, tell me if there's something you think I'm missing that we have to analyze in the sugya. This is how the Gemara presents it here, right? Did anyone get a chance to look at Bava Basra? Okay, good. So how does the Gemara in Bava Basra start?
With it saying how... I read it fast, I'm sorry.
How does the Gemara start, yeah?
It starts listing the order of the...
Good, right? The Gemara in Bava Basra simply does this, right? This is spoiler alert for people who haven't looked at it, right? The Gemara in Bava Basra simply says, right? These are the books in the Torah. These are the order of the books in Tanakh, really. And this is who wrote them. Right? And once the Gemara is talking about authorship, what does it do? It introduces this discussion almost identically, right? And says, oh, Yeshua wrote them, right? Right? Yeshua katav svaro b'shmona psukim shabbatorah, right? Does this brisa rule like Rabbi Shimon, right? And does that lead to the halachic implication of Yachid Karayotam? And the Gemara goes to the whole exercise again, right? No, right? This is an independent discussion. Okay? A point I will make, you can take it or leave it, but I think it is worth making, right? Which is, in both places, right, the Gemara introduces this discussion, right? Did Yeshua write the last Ipsukim of the Torah? Did Moshe write the last Ipsukim of the Torah? And the halachic implications of such statements, right? If I asked you, as a modern person, right, living in 2019, right? The statement that not all of the Torah was written by Moshe Rabbeinu, right? That statement goes in category what, right? Like, what shir would I introduce that in? Right, like controversial topics, biblical criticism, I don't know, right? Challenges of modernity, philosophy, I don't know, take your pick, right? The halacha that the last Ipsuk in the Torah, Yachid Karayotam, I introduce in what shir? I don't know, right? Gabai halacha, right? For Yosef, right? When you get to the last Ipsukim of the Torah, on Simchas Torah, so then if you want, Yachid Koreotam, right? Or you must Yachid Koreotam, however you understand that line, right? And this is just, I think, a generic point about Shas, but maybe you never thought about it, but I think it's actually striking, right? Which is, the Gemara in Bava Basra introduces this discussion in the middle of a question about authorship, right? Who wrote the books of Tanakh? Like, head on, right? There's a philosophical or whatever, historical, theologically loaded Gemara, right? Who wrote the books of Tanakh? What is the order of the books of Tanakh, right? And in the middle of that discussion says, by the way, there are halachic implications. In the Gemara in Menachot, it goes the opposite, which is, right, we're talking about halacha of Sefer Torah. The Gemara says, by the way, once we're talking about the Sefer Torah, if you get to the last eight psukim, there's a halacha you should know about called Yachid Koreotam. And by the way, that hangs on huge historical, theological question. Who wrote the Torah? Right? I just find it striking and worth remembering that the Gemara has no problem, right? The lines that we make in how we divide up our learning are fundamentally arbitrary and very anti-Talmudic, right? Meaning the Gemara will start with run-of-the-mill, Gabai-esque questions of who can get which aliyah, essentially, right? And launch from there without blinking an eye into the largest historical theological questions we have, which is who wrote the Torah, right? And was all the Torah given by Moshe? Right, these are the things like we put literally in the Animamim. This is not like a right, not an exaggeration. Right, who wrote the Torah? Right, and in another sugya, it will be talking about these heady, right, theological historical questions, and we'll say, oh, by the way, right, remember that these questions that are omdim berumo shel olam, like the things that are fundamentals of faith, they like spill over into like the nitty gritty of the yom yom. Right, and I'll talk about this a little bit more Wednesday night. I give an intro to Agadah this year. But one of the things that I just want you to understand about Torah in general, the Gemara in specific, is that the Gemara on purpose blurs the lines. Right? Meaning there is nothing Right? The Gemara does not think that way. It does not think the way we do. There's halacha shir, and there's Gemara shir, and then there's theology, and there's controversial topics, and there's historical and Tanakh shir. Right? The Gemara goes out of its way, and this is an argument developed very nicely by Rabbi Price for the Torontonians who know who that is, or don't know who he was. He was the leading posek in Toronto. He was Rabbi Felder Senior's Rebbe. Right, Rabbi Gedalia Felder's Rebbe. He was like the Gadol of Toronto from the 1940s to 1990 when he passed away. He built the second Eruv in Toronto. Okay, historical fact for my Torontonians, right? The first four Eruvin built in North America were what? Number one was, none of you will guess this unless you were in my share last year and you remember, right? The first Eruv in North America was built in? If you get this, I will be shocked. What?
It'll become his favorite studio.
Austin,
St. Louis. St. Louis in the 1860s. The 1860s, okay? The second Eruv was, city Eruv was?
San Francisco.
What? New York, 1905. The third Eruv in North America was?
Toronto.
Was Toronto. Built by? Before Rabbi Price? No. It was built by, how do you pronounce his name? The author of the Chavilim bin Imim. Something with a gimel, and I can't pronounce it, but that's okay. Gor Baucher, something like that. No. And it was renewed, right, and expanded under Rabbi Price when he moved in the 40s, right? Okay? So Rabbi Price, in his, when you go back to Toronto every year, Rabbi Price left a fund to carry on his legacy, because in addition to being a Talmud Chacham, he was a very wealthy man. He owned the land that currently has Yorkdale Mall. So he was a very wealthy man. So he left a trust. And one of the things the trust does is they have a dinner once a year in memory of Rabbi Price, which is a free 3-course dinner down at Shari Shamayim with a shir about Rabbi Price's Torah. So I gave it a few years ago, and Rabbi Price makes the point there, right, that this is how the Gemara is intended. Right? The Gemara wants to blur the line, and I think this is just an educational point. The Gemara doesn't believe in these sharp distinctions. It believes that things should be messy, that the categories spill over. Agadata spills into halacha, spills into theology, spills back into halacha, and therefore it is totally normal for the Gemara to launch from a very, very run-of-the-mill halacha for Gabayim about who reads the Torah into the deepest theological questions, or vice versa. Right? To start in the deepest theological questions, right? Who wrote the Torah, and then say, by the way, right? Bring the Gabbai back in for the flood, right? If you think about it, this is actually something worth thinking about, right? If you think about it like in your own shuls, the person who's good at being the Gabbai and like knows the Zmanim for davening is not necessarily the person that is like the star of the show when you are having like your deep philosophical, controversial shiurim and shul, right? Those are often different people, right? But for Chazal, that was not true. Right, the person who's like the nitty-gritty and puts up Sofzman Kriya Shema on the announcements and knows exactly what time Shkia is, right, it's 7:42 in 3 seconds, if you're on this elevation, right, that person is the same person who should be in Shir when we're doing this. That is, I think, an educational point in general, but also I figured I'd make this point on day one of Shir, which is, right, our Shir, as Yosef knows, I try to be a bit more eclectic than some of the other shirim. I don't only do Brisker Lumdus, right? I want you, when you walk out of this year, to have honed different skills in Torah, which means some of it is analytical, some of it is exegetical, right? And how to read Gemara, how to read Tanakh.
He likes to use big words also. Don't be afraid to ask what they're
analytical.
Eclectic.
Okay, anyways. I purposely don't stick to one methodology in shir. There will be shirim where we are sitting on the psukim that the halachot are based on for a day or two. Just going through the psukim, going through the mafarshim and the psukim, not looking at chazal at all, understanding where chazal came from. Right? In some, we will be analyzing the Gemara and the Rishonim. Sometimes we will spend a few days on halacha, right? Because I think it's important to realize that, right? Torah has many, many disciplines, right? And different people like different disciplines better and worse. I also ask you to bear with me, because I know some of those methodologies, and certain sugyas will speak to different ones of you in different ways. We will be doing different things, right? We will be learning in different ways, focusing in different methodologies to try to hone all those skills. That's the way I think the Gemara works, right? That's the way I want my shir to work, right? That means that different people will perk up at different ways because I'm not doing the same type of thing every day, right? That may be a bit confusing, right? Because there is a beauty to sticking with one methodology and perfecting it, and we will try to, but I also think that there are different methodologies, different things are going to speak to you differently, you're going to want to learn different ways, I want to try to provide that for you, and this sugya happens to be a good one to start with, because, as I said, right, the Gemara itself is really all over the place in terms of discipline here, right? It's jumping from Tanakh and theology into, right, halacha lemaisa and nice lumdos in between, right? And again, the Gemara will start in both places, right? One of the Gemara starts in the authorship question and gets to halacha, one starts in halacha, and like says, oh yeah, that little nitty-gritty halacha is really hangs or doesn't hang on huge theological questions, right? The fact that Gemara can do it, I think, is the heter for me to be a bit eclectic in how we do it, okay? Fine. That, by way of introduction to this sugya and all its many, 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 many parts. Okay? Now that we've done that, let's start from the ground up. We'll do this, shall I say, more Bava Basra-esque. Okay? We're not going to start with the halacha. I want to start with the theological authorship claim that the Gemara is based on, right? That's the way it's presented in Bava Basra. So let's start with that, okay? The Gemara claims there is a machlokas about the last 8 psukim in the Torah. Why? Let's start with basics. Why? What drove anybody in the Gemara to ask a question of the last 8 psukim? Yeah, Daniel.
The point of view is different. And if you start from Aleph, you go through Pasuk Dalet, talk about the thing, and then starting from Pasuk Hey,
so Moshe died, therefore, so why the last Ipsukim? Why?
It's like a cutoff. You suddenly didn't say.
So I think it's even more than that. It's not just different perspective. What is it?
It's a different orientation altogether. You ended the story arc and now you're saying something new at the end of it.
God, you guys are overthinking this.
How could Moshe have written?
Yeah, Moshe is dead. The last Ipsukim, he's dead. Right? Dead people don't write. Right? That's the problem the Gemara is starting with. Right? That's the problem the Gemara starts with. Right, that's all. Right, this should be, right, obvious. Right, the eighth pasuk from the end of the Torah is Vayamat Sham Moshe. Moshe died. Right, now yes, now it is then a eulogy essentially for Moshe. Right, Vayamat Sham Moshe. Right, I remember when I was in yeshiva Shana Aleph, on Simchas Torah, Rav Meidan was the Bal Korei, and Rav Amital Zechon Levracha was Chasan Torah. And Rav Meidan gets very into his laning. He gets very into the story. So he got to Vayamat Sham Moshe, and
changes to him.
No, he burst out crying and could not continue. Right, he had to gather himself because he was so hurt because Moshe died, right? If you really like understand what Moshe did for us, right, you might cry, right? Vayamat Sham Moshe Adonai be'eretz Moav al pi Adonai vayikbarato bagai be'eretz Moav mul beit po'or v'lo yada ish et gvurato ad hayom hazeh, right? He died, no one can visit his kever, right? Can you imagine, right? Like, I'm not like a big kever person, but can you imagine, right, the lines I at least hope this is true. I'm going to pray to God that what I'm about to say is true, and if it's not, and part of me thinks it might not be, I'm going to be very sad. Knowing how long the lines are and how busy it is at Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's kever on Lag BaOmer, one would hope that if we knew where Moshe was buried, that it would be even busier. I'm not sure that that is true, right? But I do hope it is. But we don't know yet.
And the Christians argue that we do, right? They have their spot just next to Jordan.
The Muslims also have traditions. There are a lot of traditions about exactly where he is buried. That is true, but we don't know for sure, as the Torah tells us, right? And then we get this eulogy, Moshe ben Me'ah ben Shim Shana ben Moto, lo chata, eino v'lo nas lecho, right? He was 120, his eyes were still functioning, his skin still maintained its moisture, right? Meaning he wasn't he wasn't a wrinkly old man who couldn't continue, meaning he could. The only reason he didn't continue was because God said it's over, right? He didn't like die of old age. He died because God said it's over, right? Vayivku b'nei Yisrael Moshe barvot Moab shloshim yom vayitmu yimei vecheiv Moshe, etc. Okay, right? This is the end of the Torah, right? It's beautiful, right? Very simple. The reason we know that the last eight psukim are different is because Moshe is dead. Okay? Moshe is dead. Now,
according to...
No. We know they're different because Moshe is dead. That is not question. There is no other way of reading the words Vayamat Sham Moshe than Moshe died. Moshe is dead.
What was the thing you said?
Okay?
Moshe Bival. We didn't know what the word meant.
What?
It was either Yoshua or Moshe Bival.
Bidema. Okay, wait. So the Gemara claims, right? This is the problem. Let's do this very methodically here. This is the problem, okay? Is that Moshe is dead. How does Moshe write? Now, what is the problem? Now, what exactly is the problem? This is the generic problem, but what actually? Let's pin it down. What is the problem?
How could it have been finished if you...
What is the problem? Right? Why can't Moshe write? Yeah, Darius.
Because you can't write if you are dead.
Right, so one way of understanding this is, right, dead people don't write books. Okay? Except the Rav, who has written like 50 books since he passed away. That's fine. Right? Most dead people don't write books. Right? Yeah, exactly. Okay, what else might be the problem? Because how can you solve this problem?
He just wrote his own death.
Yeah, right? The problem would be, right, maybe he wrote it in Nebuah before he died. Which would lead us to second problem, which is...
It says in the Pasukim that to bring down the Torah is if a complete...
Wait. What else would the problem be, right? Right, you could solve this b'nevuah. What would be the problem with solving it with this? I want you to understand where the Gemara is coming from. Right, this is an easy answer. Right, as we'll see, some of them first are going to say, good, so Moshe wasn't alive. You know what? He also wrote about things that happened way before his birth, like...
Avraham,
Yitzhak, Yaakov, the creation of the world, things that he couldn't have seen. How did he write it? Answer. He is a prophet. He can do that. So why don't you just say, okay, dead people don't write books, but...
He could have written his own.
But dead prophets, they can write it before they die. Dead people don't die, but he wrote it while he was alive. What's the problem?
It's kind of cruel to make someone write about their own death.
So there's cruel, right? That's... One possibility is it's cruel. Now, that is definitely one way of reading what? Right? And that's going to help us explain what claim? Good. Right? Is the answer, right? If you think the word bedema, and like I said, this can mean different things, but at least one meaning of the word bedema means in tears, right? Right? This may be part of what's going on. Is yeah, he could write it because he's a Navi, but it's still different because... Emotionally, something was so different, right, about how he wrote it, that changes it. Okay, but there's a bigger problem than that's cruel, right? Meaning, I don't know if I would be so sad if God said, look, like right now, right, the average life expectancy is what? In Israel for men, like 85, 83, something in the 80s, whatever it is. If God said, right now, your death story, and say, you know, I died at 120, and I had all my strength, I'd be like, okay, I got another, almost 90 years to go, and I'm not going to be sick until the day I die. You know, there could be worse things to write about myself, but... what? There's another problem here, which is
Moshe was the most humble person ever.
Okay, that fine,
so
but
he wouldn't write Lokami.
Okay, but you could just say, well, God made him write it. But you're right, right? It's a little bit out of character for Moshe to write it. But what else? Right? There's a bigger problem here, right? Grammar people, what's the problem here? The tense. What's the tense? Thank you. Right. There's a different problem. It's not about whether he knows he's going to die. It's, right, is can he write it
in past tense?
If he don't.
Proof, right, yes, of past tense. Right. This is not a question of whether he knows it's going to happen. Right? This is not an information question. It's, is Moshe allowed to write
past tense.
In the past tense, and Moshe died, because clearly he isn't writing it then.
He hasn't been told that people would read the Torah in the past tense, wouldn't you?
But you understand. The potential, this is what I want to point out. The potential reasons to drive you to the claim that Yehoshua wrote it are either dead people don't write, but you could solve that with Nevuah, right? But the problem that you're going to run into, right, is he's not just writing that this is going to happen, he's writing that this has already happened. Now, Nevuah can't help you there, right? Nevuah can't make that statement true. It can tell you what's going to happen. It doesn't necessarily allow you. Right? Again, we're going to see all these in the Mefarshim, but I want you just to understand where the Mefarshim are coming from. Starting, by the way, with the Mefarshim of Tanakh. I mean, the members of Chazal. Right? So when Reb Shimon says, Moshe is dead, cannot be written by Moshe, he's saying that because dead people don't write books, and even if you could solve it with Nevuah, that's not so simple because, right, it's written in past tense, and that would be a lie. Right? Now, let's assume all of this. What are we then going to have to explain? Methodologically. Right? This is always the rule. It's a rule I learned at the beginning of Shana Aleph. If you want to understand a machloket, always start with the side that makes more sense, and then, right, pick the side that makes most sense to you, and then
try to disprove it.
And then try to explain the other side. Right? Meaning, start with the one that is easier for you to explain and then try to figure out the one who argues. So let's say it's easier to explain why Yehoshua wrote it. Now you got to ask then, how does the word Moshe Katav Bidema solve all these problems? Right? Dead people don't write books. Even if they do, they don't write it in past tense. Right?
Who's considered dead?
We can come up with all types of answers, but this is, I'm just highlighting what we have to analyze. Right? Now, there's another problem that we're not going to... We will do when we finish this. But there's another problem that the Gemara never mentions, but should stare you in the face when you read the Psukim. Let's see if anyone caught it. Right? It's this. This number bothers me just a little bit. Right? What might bother me about this number?
This is what I was talking about before. That he could, if you're telling Moshe, if the Pasukim says to bring down the Torah...
No, that's going to be part of Rabbi Yehuda's claim. Rabbi Yehuda's claim, which we'll get to, is this can't be true. Why? Because Moshe has to give the whole Torah, right? That's trying to minimize this to zero. That's Rabbi Yehuda, right? I'm going the other way, right? Rabbi Yehuda takes it down from 8 to 0. But there's another problem, which is that 8 doesn't quite fit it. Why? Do you read the whole Pasukim?
The Pasuk says to bring...
What?
Are there more than 8 Pasukim left?
No, there are 8. There are 8 from Yimachem Moshe, but there's a problem. What happens right before Moshe dies?
You're told to bring down the Torah.
No. What is he told right before? Good. Where is he? Good. Please tell me a problem.
How does one...
Yes, there's a problem that Ibn Ezra is going to highlight here, right, is that starting 12 psukim from the end of the Torah, not 8, right, what happens? Moshe leaves never to return. Right? Pasuk Aleph in Perek Lamed Dalet is Vayal Moshe Merfot Moav. I mean, Moshe leaves never to return and no one knows where he went. Remember that part of the Torah? Right? No one knows where he's buried. So yes, he only dies in Pasuk Hay. But there are 4 psukim before he dies, at which, if he wrote them, how did we get those psukim back? Right? He wrote them where? At the top of a mountaintop, right? And then never returned. And then what? He paper airplaned them off the mountain, right, to the Jewish people. They don't know, like, it was a
message in a bottle.
Yes, but remember, this is according to the Shita. If you think Yehoshua wrote, fine. But if you think that Moshe wrote it, because you don't, right? Right? Meaning, it's the same problem. That's the only thing the Ibn Ezra will note, is that whatever you say about these 8, you potentially have to justify for 4 more. Right? Which is Moshe dies in Pasuk Hay, but he disappears in Pasuk Aleph. But we're not going to get to that until later. Because that's... Remember I said that part of this sugya gets it sort of tiptoes dangerously into biblical criticism, right? This is where that happens. Is where the Ibn Ezra, as we will see, erases the Gemara as if it never happened and said, yeah, well, by 8 they mean 12. Right? Okay? We're going to come back to that. Okay? But bracket that, yeah.
What if it's not a problem? Because what if we know, or we assume Bnei Israel knew where Har Nevo is,
and then we just don't know where most of the better.
Okay, good. There are many ways we can solve it, and you will see that there will be...
see the land on Hargobo.
Good.
He's going to die. They go up to find him dead and look up something.
Good. And as you will see, most of them approach him. We're not nearly as bothered by this as the Ibn Ezra, but...
But the Torah also says that that we don't know where he's buried to this day. That the day it was written, if that's the case, they knew.
Well, no, it sounds like no one ever knew. But we could... Certain Mepharshim are going to say that Ibn Ezra is wrong. What?
Did they see Moshe go up?
Sounds like not, right? He just sort of disappears.
So following that logic.
Right? Okay. Okay, so far, I'm assuming this is a lot to digest, so take a second, right, breathe, right? Let's now read through the Gemara carefully, right, and see how all these questions, all these problems, right, this is just the nature of Gemara, right? It's sometimes a, 15 lines, right, just laying out the questions and the problems and the axes upon which there are going to be machlokot. Will take you quite a while. So let's just read through the Gemara carefully and make sure we see where all the questions, right, all these sort of questions we talked about outside, how they fit back into the Gemara, right, and then we will see how much time we have left to actually get into them, okay? So let's read through it carefully. I know some of you read the Gemara. So, who wants to read it for me?
Come on, guys, come on. Step it up.
The Gemara, The Gemara.
We did two of them.
The Gemara in our Masechet. How about that? Okay. Who wants to read it? Or should I read it? It'd be nice.
I'll read Last Resort.
What? Do I see a volunteer? Fine, fine. Today I won't torture you. But by tomorrow, I didn't warn you. Now I'm warning you. Right? I want you guys to participate in the reading, and I know that that's uncomfortable. Trust me, when I was in Shir in Yeshiva, we all used to sit in terror of the possibility of being called on. It was the scariest experience of our lives. And I mean that not at all with any exaggeration, right? The prospect of being called on by Rav Lichtenstein was beyond terrifying. The only thing that was scarier than being called on by Rav Lichtenstein was when I returned to be in the Kollel, and then I had to give an hour in the Kollel Chabura in front of Rav Lichtenstein, where he criticized everything from your lumdus to your grammar to your lack of knowledge of parallels in Greek philosophy. It was like, and we're talking about a Gemara Shir. This is not like a, right? He, at one point when I was in Shir, someone gave a Chabura on the red string that turned to white of the Kohen Gadol. This was an Israeli who doesn't really speak English. And Rav Lichtenstein criticized him because he missed the importance of red as a symbol in the scarlet letter. Okay, it was a terrifying experience, right? So I get it. It is scary. I'm not that scary, okay? What? Okay, good. Fine. So, Amar Rav Yeshua bar Abba, Amar Rav Gidol, Amar Rav. Okay? Shmone psukim shebatara yachid kore otan. Right? So, as I said, the Gemara in Menachot introduces this as a halachic discussion. Right? The last eight psukim, the Torah, an individual can, must. Right? I hope you already see the ambiguity. Right? Once we get to this phrase of yachid kore otan, understanding it is going to require us to read that kore, right? Kore can be translated as can or must, right? You can already tell that is going to be the subject of machloket. Right? Again, I just want to read the Gemara and see where every machloket comes from a very carefully read, right? Carefully reading the psukim. Yachid kore otam b'beit ha-kneset. So the Gemara says, kiman, right? According to whom? Dilo kirib shimon. This is not like Rib Shimon Ditanya. Vayamacham Moshe Eved Hashem. Right. Moshe Dai, the servant of God. Efshar Moshe Chai. Vikatav Vayamat Sham Moshe. Is it possible that Moshe is dead and is writing past tense? Is it possible Moshe is alive and is writing past tense and Moshe is dead? Ella Ad Kan Katav Moshe. Until this point in the Torah, the first 5,880 psukim, Moshe wrote the Torah. Mikan va'elach katav Yoshua ben Nun divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says the last eight psukim are written by Yoshua. Ve'amri la Rabbi Nechemya. Some say it wasn't Rabbi Yehuda, it was Rabbi Nechemya. Amr lo Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon now says. Now, again, Why does Rabbi Yehuda think that Moshe didn't write it? It sounds like the past tense, right? Efshar Moshe Chai. Is it possible Moshe is alive and he's writing Vayamat? Reb Shimon introduces a theological critique of Rabbi Yehuda / Reb Nechemiah's position, which is Efshar Sefer Torah Chaser Ot Achat Uktiv Lakoch Et Sefer Torah Zev Samtem Oto Vigomer. Right, Moshe is told give the Torah. What is the Torah?
The whole thing,
right? A Torah becomes kosher when it is done, right? You've ever been to Achnasat Sefer Torah, right? You finish the last letters. Until then, it is nothing. It is not a Sefer Torah, right? Torah must have everything in it. Moshe is told to give the Torah to the Jewish people. How could he give the Torah to the Jewish people if, right? If you have a single letter, right? You get up there for an aliyah, you're reading the Parsha of Rosh Chodesh, and it says, I don't know, Tamid, without a Yud, right? It is what? It is Pasul, right? It is invalid. And a single letter is missing, and it's invalid. And yet, you're positing that Moshe gave what was considered by God to be the complete Torah, even though it's missing 8 psukim. Now, how would you solve that problem? Right? What... Right, Reb Shimon has this theological problem, which is the Torah must be complete. Now, what might be the answer be?
I know a halachic answer.
Yeah.
You could have a shaliach.
Sure. Right. But what? How else might you answer? Right. What's the problem here? Right. Reb Shimon has a theological response, meaning, right? Yehuda, Rabbi Nechemiah, whoever it is, says that they are convinced the 8 psukim are written not by Moshe but by Yoshua because textually. It talks about Moshe being dead in the past tense. That is a lie. Right? That is untrue. Reb Shimon, does he answer that question?
No.
What? No, I erased it several times. But I'm good now. Well, yeah, you can take it. There's only one working marker. Sorry.
I wasn't prepared for that.
Does Reb Shimon answer of Yehuda's historical claim, or theological claim, or whatever claim? No. Right? Meaning he... This is interesting, but does he seem to be bothered by Yehuda's claim? No, he seems to be... If I read it, I would say he's overwhelmed by a theological / exegetical problem. Right? Yosef's like, why are you using these words? He's overwhelmed by either a philosophy problem, which is, I can't believe that the Torah was ever not complete, or a textual problem, which is, the Torah says that Moshe gave the Torah, I think the word Torah means everything. Right? How might Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Nechemiah respond to that?
He wrote it preemptively knowing the Nebuah.
No. Rabbi Yehuda, who thinks that Moshe didn't write it. Didn't write the last 8, yeah.
It's not part of the Torah?
So you could say it's not part of the Torah. That's a very radical claim, right? Or
part of not.
Well, Yeshua got Nebuah, how would you solve the problem? Is this called the Torah if it's missing letters? What might the answer be?
Or maybe up to that point it was
missing letters.
Yeah, like it's what do you right? At this point, this is as complete as the Torah could be. So Moshe gave whatever he could give, and then the rest, Yeshua finished it off. Like, big deal. Right? What are you getting so worked up about? Right? Or as some of the Mepharshim note, like every Torah starts out puzzle. Right? It's puzzle. 5,887 and a half psukim in. Right? It's puzzle until that last letter. Big deal. Do you think that what a sofer does is meaningless until you get to the last letter? No, he just hasn't finished. So when God said, give the Torah, he meant, like, give the Torah. Like, when you go to Achnasat Sefer Torah, even though technically, halachically, it's true, like, after the last letter is written, like, magic, it's now a kosher Sefer Torah, right? You wouldn't want someone going up to the Torah before the last letter is written and, like, start shredding it. Right? Like, this is a Torah in process. Like, you still might refer to it as a Torah. Right? Yeah.
But wouldn't that be because that has Hashem's name on it, not because it's becoming a Torah?
Really? If I said, hey, we're going to Achnasat Sefer Torah, they're going to finish writing the Torah. Would you get annoyed at the grammarian who would say, they're not finishing the Torah, they are going to complete something which will become a Torah at the end. You can't complete the Torah, it's not complete. Right?
For earthly purposes, right? Like the
correct, but how annoying is that person? Right? No, I understand. But it's not crazy to say Torah means, like, the Torah, everything in the Torah up to what Moshe could write. Give that, and then the rest will be... You know, and if you look at the Gemara in Bava Basra, which I, you know, you can look at, the Torah, shocking, is not the only book like this. How many books were written by more than one person according to the continuation of the Gemara? Almost all of them. Yoshua, according to the Gemara, wrote his book until he died. And then it was picked up by people after his death. Right? Shmuel writes his book, Shoftim, and his book until, surprise, he dies. Right? And then God and Natan pick up. Right? There are a lot of books like this where people die, like the main character dies, and then, you know, so the Gemara just says, yeah, like, this is not only, like, yes, the Torah is different. But, like, fundamentally, it doesn't bother you when I say Yoshua wrote most of his book. Right? Yeah, like, the end he didn't write. Right? He's like someone who writes... Has anyone ever read the last lecture? The last lecture was a book which was put out by... It was a series of lectures... Okay. There, at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, there was a series of lectures that they used to have which were called something like the last lecture, which was... A professor would come in and talk, give one lecture theoretically about his death. Like, if I had the last lecture I could give in my life, this is what it would be. Okay? And then at some point they had a professor, Randy Pausch, I think is how you pronounce his last name, or Pausch, or something like that. I think I got that right. Who was diagnosed with terminal cancer and therefore actually gave his last lecture, right? And it became very popular because, you know, it was actually a dying man giving you his last lecture and it was turned into a book, right? No one gets, like, worked up. No one will say, oh, Randy didn't write the book because, you know, at the very end of the book it says, and Randy died, you know, 4 months after publication, whatever. Everyone understands, like, he's a dying man. He writes the book until the end and then, like, so there's an epilogue at the end, right? Beloved professor, Randy died on blah, 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 right?
You know?
Yeah, like, it's not, like, crazy. You could say... Now, obviously, right? Obviously, Moshe's a bit different, right? Moshe, this is the Torah and not some random book. And Moshe is Moshe and not a computer science professor at Carnegie Mellon University. And, you know, sure, the words that... But, like, it's not al panav insane for someone to claim, yeah, Moshe gave the Torah. Like you can imagine Yehudarim Nehemiah saying, listen, calm down. Moshe gave the Torah. Yeah, he didn't give the last eight psukim of the Torah. He gave the Torah, you know, like up to where he could possibly give, he gave. And then he died, and Yeshua finished it up, and wrote the epilogue, and wrote about Moshe's life, and how great a guy he was. And like, it's fundamentally Moshe's book. Right, again, you can see both sides of this, right? You can see Rabbi Shimon is taking the position, no, the Torah is unique, right? It's complete, it's an atomic unit called the Torah. You can't break it up, 5,880 and 8, right? And then you can imagine Yehuda and Nehemiah saying, Tiraga, right? Cool it, calm down, you're okay, right? It's called the Torah even before then. Okay. Then the Gemara continues and it says, Ella, but he agrees, but Reb Shimon has to agree that what? Even if Reb Shimon, right, doesn't think that Yoshua wrote the last eight psukim, what does he have to agree to? What does he need to explain? But why does he need to say those words? Because what does he need to say? Well, no. Remember, the Gemara is taking two different statements that exist independently and trying to connect them, but then it'll split it apart, right? Which means that you have to view Nehemiah's statement and Yehuda's statement and Shimon's statement independent of the halacha, right? This is an important point, right? The fact is, right, the Gemara rejects the connection in the end, right? The Gemara is taking two separate statements and trying to connect them, but they stand independently, which is how the Gemara concludes. What does Shimon need to explain?
How?
Right? Is that Rabbi Yehuda has a very easy way of explaining how the Torah was written. Namely, the last eight psukim after Moshe is dead are not written by Moshe. Easy. That may carry theological weight. Right? That may carry theological problems. But it's easy enough of a claim. Moshe's dead, so he didn't write it. Right? Reb Shimon is claiming that dead people do write books. Right? So now he has to explain it. Now, he isn't willing to actually sign on to that. He doesn't think Moshe wrote it posthumously. He thinks that Moshe wrote it while he's alive. But now he has a problem. How did Moshe write it? So he somehow solves the theological issues, the historical issues, the truth issues with this magic word, which is dema. Now you understand why we need to explain what? How does that solve every problem that we just built up? But that's what the Gemara says. Right? The Gemara says, Amar lo, El ad kana kadosh baruch hu omer, u'moshe kotev ve'omer. The first 5,880 psukim, Moshe would write at God's dictation. Moshe would verbalize and write. Okay? From now on, I'm ikan ve'elach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer Moshe Kotev Bidema. From then on, Moshe something. Something. Well, no, something. He didn't. Well, let's just figure out what we know here. That would be interesting, but it doesn't sound that way. It has Moshe Katav. Right? That would be a theoretical solution. Right? Now we're going to see. There is a version of what you just said, which is right now. Now, let's try to translate the word bidema, because as you can see, this is going to cause a lot of problems. Okay, what is the ambiguity around the word bidema?
It's with something,
right? It means with something, with dema. What can the word with mean? I'm being nitpicky, but I'm not really.
Person.
I mean, it could, but that's clearly not what it means here. But what might it mean in context? What? Ah, right, meaning it could be describing context, or it could be describing, right, meaning he wrote it while crying, let's say. Right, what else might it mean?
A tool.
Yeah, it could be that bi means, no, like literally, the tool. Like he wrote it in tears, not while crying. Right, meaning, you know how idioms can be taken literally? When you say you do something in tears, right? There are two ways of meaning that. As an idiom, it means while crying. If you took it literally, it means... Wah, cry, put it in a cup, put the quill in the tears, and write in tears instead of in ink. Right, literally. Right? That is, by the way, how several Rishonim take this. Bidema doesn't mean while crying, in tears, meaning metaphorically, it means literally. Bidema. Can you not? Really? Can you write with water?
You can't see it, though.
Ooh. Yeah. And? And therefore what?
I mean, it's like using a white crayon. Like, yes, there you're writing
with it. Is it?
You're not going to see it unless you...
Unless you do what?
You have contracts.
Or what? Ooh. Or you trace it. Right? Remember you said maybe Moshe wrote it, dictated to Yeshua? There is another option. Right? And then you'll see, some of the Rishonim understand this way, which is, there's a way which is almost like dictation, which is, write it in almost invisible ink. Right? Literally. Right? Write it. It's not true. Does water totally disappear? Right? Can you tell? Right, you can if you look very, very carefully, you can see, right?
It also ruins the paper.
It's like the coffee stains.
This is parchment. It doesn't get ruined so easily. Right? Parchment doesn't get right. Pro tip. Take a dollar bill, right? No, I don't think this will work with Israeli money, but take an American. Right? Take American here. This is not a dollar, but whatever. Right? Here. Right? Get this wet. What will happen to it?
It'll be wet.
Will it rip? Will it get ruined easily?
You can. Yeah.
Wrong. It's not made of paper. It's made of cloth. Right? There's enough cloth in this. You can, right? They are not perfectly paper. Right? You can actually wash these. If you go to the mint, they'll tell you that. Right? You can actually... Yeah. Okay? Right? There you go. Right? If you go to the mint, that's what they say. I haven't gone in a very long time. But it's not actually pure. So if you get it wet, right? It won't tear, but there will be... Right? You'll see a little bit of a...
Water damage.
Right? Whatever, an imprint. Right? And if you cared enough, you could... Like, haven't you ever watched, like, any crime TV shows or movies, right? Like, you know, they, like, The criminal wrote a note on the pad of paper, and he took the note with him, but underneath there is the faintest of imprints, right? And if you look very carefully, right, you can trace it, right?
A dollar for cocaine.
So some Rishonim will say that that's exactly what Moshe did. He wrote it bedema. He wrote it in tears, and like, he wrote it in invisible ink, right? So that Yoshua, it was the next best thing of dictating. He wrote it in invisible ink, and like after he died, Yoshua could sit there with the Torah and say, "Oh, I sort of can make out what this says," right? And fill it in.
It's like National Treasure, the back of the back of the back.
Yes, that's exactly what this is. I don't know what you're talking about, but
seriously?
Sure. What?
National Treasure, Nicolas Cage from Disney.
Sure, Moshe Rabbeinu is Nicolas Cage. No. That is what I gathered from what you just said. I thought he was Charles Heston, but that's fine. Whatever. Yeah.
Solve the problem with past tense.
Ah, well, how would it solve the problem with past tense? You tell how might it?
I mean, unless Yeshua.
He died, and then Yeshua wrote it.
Which means, exactly, right? Unless you think that invisible ink doesn't count, right? From which you would... Now, one of the parts of the sugya I don't want to get too much into is that there's a lot of discussion in, like, the Achronim. What do we learn from this about lying in writing? Do you violate lying in writing, right? And all types of things, right? But, yeah, a plausible conclusion of this is writing a lie in invisible ink, right, or disappearing ink is not a problem because it's not permanent, right? And by time Moshe and by time Yeshua got around to it, it was now indeed in past tense, right? It's like someone sketched out his death, right? This is what I imagine my death will be like, right? So I will write it in invisible ink, right? Or open upon my demise, right? Or something like that. I don't know, right?
Doesn't that essentially mean Yeshua wrote it anyways? He's changing up words and things.
Ah, so if you now what? Now, Daniel is right, that this shita, this position, that it was written and then rewritten by Yeshua, is an attempt, right, by those Rishonim to have their cake and eat it too, right? Which is, Moshe really did write it. He just, like, he did and he didn't. But you're right, right? That's exactly what those Rishonim understand the word bedema to mean, which is, now, methodologically speaking, right, Daniel's picking up something, which is, the Rishonim who think bedema means an invisible ink, right, half buy, right? They buy both claims. You can't really write it, but you can't not write it, right? So he wrote it, it counted enough to make the Torah complete, right? But it's, like, literally what it's saying is, Moshe wrote the last 8 psukim in disappearing ink. And therefore, for a moment, the Torah was complete, but it wasn't a lie, because it was going to vaporize, right? Right, that's essentially what he's saying. Okay, good. Now, there are other ways of understanding it, right? Which is, no, he wrote it while crying. But if you think it's while crying, then you got to figure out, so what? So he was crying, and therefore what? And therefore it's not a lie? Right? If I tell a lie while I am crying, it is not a lie? Right? That's good to know, right? If I cry enough, right? This is, by the way, bad advice, right? You know, someone lies. You know, there was a study... There was a study once. It's a wonderful study. Again, I'm not sure whether it was a joke, but there was a professor who ran a study who said that it was amazing that in the last 2 weeks of a semester, when during exams, grandparents tend to die with increasing frequency. Now, his conclusion, I kid you not, was clearly people share their troubles at school with their grandparents and their hearts can't handle it, which leads to an increased death. And then the response was, no, it's called lying, you idiot. Right? But the point is, you can lie and cry. Right? It is still lying. Right? So you have to figure out, so what, he's crying, and therefore it's not a lie. Right? I'm dying. Right? I'm dead, rather. Right? It's not less of a lie if he's crying while he writes, I am dead. Right? So if you think it means that, you have to figure out what that would mean, yeah.
The first option, where he wrote the tears and Yeshua traced it, but some of them got lost.
Not lost, whatever. But they...
But when Yeshua's writing it, obviously, he's not stupid. So he knows how Moshe wrote the whole thing. He would have known Moshe didn't write any of the words in past tense. So why would he then
this would be different. No, it's great. It's God dictates, Moshe writes, meaning it's this position is trying to maintain the divine dictation of the Torah to Moshe without having Moshe write a lie. So the way he does that is Moshe writes down from God word verbatim what God wants him to write, which maintains the divine, pristine nature of Torah, but he writes it in disappearing ink, which solves the lie problem, and then Yeshua, once it's no longer a lie, right, actually writes it. Right? Again, that's not necessarily a solution, but I want you to understand where that cheetah is coming from. Yeah.
Why is it considered a lie?
See, that would be, right? So it's interesting, right? That no one just says, what's the problem? Right? So he wrote it. Now, that may be, now, Daniel may be right. That may be the answer for the people who think it means in tears. Or the answer is, no. Right? This answer is really what? Rejecting the whole premise, which is why can't you write the future in past tense if it's nevuah? Right? So he cried, right? Because it was sad. He was writing his death. But there's no theological problem. So what? There's no lying. It's not lying. God, right? No one's going to accuse. Everyone understands why he had to write his death before he died. Right? It's not like Moshe was trying to lie to you. He just,
like, his ghost can write for
him. Right? He just can't, right? He can't continue, right? Yeah.
If disappearing ink counts as completing the Torah, can you have written in present tense and then Yoshua description of the past tense?
Interesting, but then you might lose the divine dictation. Right? Meaning, this answer is really trying to square a lot of circles. Again, once we see them inside, right, we'll sort of flesh it out. Right? Today I want to, right, I'm introducing all the positions, and then as you read them, I want to flesh. You understand how many questions there are in this sugya? This sugya is a great sugya because there's a lot going on in it, and each claim has to be analyzed at like 10 levels, but you're right. Right? Meaning, there are assumptions being made by this claim. Let's just try to get to the end of the Gemara, and tomorrow we'll try to pin these down. So then the Gemara tries to prove it. K'mashen e'amar la'alan v'yomer lam baruch mipiv yikra elai called v'rema ila v'ani kotev al sefer bidyo. Right? The later pasuk says that he would write it, but the key there being, right, there's a pasuk actually from Yirmiyahu, right, it's using it as a mashal, right, but that normally you write it bidyo. Right here, he didn't write it bidyo, right? Later it was written bidyo, but he's writing it bidema. And it proves that normally things are dictated and then written. So the Gemara then comes back to its original halachic claim. Remember, we came into this because of halachic claim, which is lema deloker b'shimon. Right? Is it only true that yachid koreyotam, according to Rabbi Yehuda, that the Torah, the last eight psukim, were written by a different author? And the Gemara's answer is, no, afilu tema rib shimon hold ishni ishni. Right? The authorship question and the halakha question are independent because everybody agrees that the last eight psukim are somehow different from the rest of the Torah. And since they're somehow different, they are halachically different. Right? So the Gemara's conclusion, again, is that the halakha has nothing to do with the theological claim being put forth.
Is that everyone agrees on in the end, that for the Gemara, that
everyone agrees, according to the Gemara, everyone agrees that Yachid Koreotam, whatever that means,
those eight psukim are intrinsically different.
But everyone agrees they're different, whether because Yeshua wrote them or because Moshe Katav Videma, whatever that means. Okay? So tomorrow, if you've been following all the problems here, and there's a lot of them, right? Our goals are, again, we're going to bracket the Ibn Ezra problem until when we're done with this whole sugya, which is 12:8. I don't want to get into that yet, but in case that was bothering you, we'll hold off on that. Tomorrow, what I want to do is, let's start with the Dema question, which is, look at all the sheetot. What exactly does Dema mean? What does it mean that you wrote it? And two things. What does Bedema mean? And how does it solve all the problems? And then, how does, right, Reb Shimon respond to Reb Yehuda? Does Reb Yehuda respond to Reb Shimon? Right? When we finish that, we'll then go to, okay, what is this halachic claim that we are analyzing? Yachid Koreotam, what does it mean? And what justifies it? Okay? Those are our goals. I assume that will take us a few days. Each of those will take time. But tomorrow we're going to start with the Bedema question. Try to, if you haven't finished the Gemara, make sure you know how to read the Gemara. If you finish the Gemara, move on to the Rishonim and the Achronim on the words Bedema. We'll see there's basically 3-4 positions of what it means. I'll give you some more of the sources tomorrow, okay? We're good. Anything you need going into tomorrow? I know that's a lot. Hopefully you can try to digest it. We're good? Okay.
Thank you.